Welcome to Nui Tech People, episode 19. Today we interview Josh Peak, one of the more prominent members of the Newcastle tech community. Josh is the organizer of the Newcastle JS meetup and also the new meetup, Newcastle Data. Josh provides a heap of information in this episode, but also a wealth of information in the show links. So I hope you enjoy this episode and feel free to hit up our website, newitechpeople.com.au/podcast for some information on anything that Josh discussed today. Hope you enjoy the episode. Episode 19 of Nui Tech People. Today we have Josh Peak, data engineer at Komatsu Mining. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time to come across here. But you're quite well known around the Newcastle tech scene from your involvement in the meetups and also on the Nui Slack community. Mate, for those that don't know you, give us a quick overview of who you are.
Well, I'm a data engineer that works at the Komatsu Smart Solutions. So I'm also recently qualified as a data scientist.
Yeah.
So they get that extra bonus without the change of my contract. Hopefully going to renegotiate that, we'll see. So quick disclaimer, everything that I say here is my own opinion, doesn't represent any company that I'm part of now or have previously represented, or organizations or institutions. But what we do at Komatsu is trying to make sure the mining machines can keep digging, moving a lot of dirt. That's essentially it.
Yeah.
It's really expensive when they stop. It's just like if an aeroplane,
yeah,
you know, it's at the terminal waiting for people to get on, but it's like a $2 hose, which is preventing it from taking off. That's like millions of dollars of passengers getting rebooked. So if one of these shovels or loaders isn't moving dirt, it's like that's millions of dollars just wasting away.
Wow.
So yeah, we do a lot of predictive analytics to make sure they keep running. And given that they're very big machines, it's very expensive to get into the innards of an engine or a gearbox every maintenance schedule. So we try to look at a lot of the sensors and try to see symptoms and sort of, oh, now's the time that you want to see that. All right, this wheel is 50 degrees hotter than it should be. Turns out it was on fire inside the tire. Wow. Things like that.
Sounds pretty pretty interesting, you know, a role that most people probably wouldn't even realize exists, right?
No, for years I was like, Newcastle, mining, coal, I don't want to get into that. But here I am. It's actually a very interesting space, and I spoke to someone that was very influential in why I've transitioned into the mining industry. They said, if you want to see that industry change, the only people that can do it are the people that are working there. So that was very interesting take on it. So there's actually a lot of greenies that work for the mining companies trying to affect a more ethical way of running mines.
Yeah, nice. That's a really good perspective and something that's probably not overly common, right?
No, I didn't know it until I got in there.
Yeah, nice. So you've grown into that role, obviously. Mate, what got you into technology to begin with? How's that path from that evolved into where you are now?
Started when I was primary school sort of age. Got the first home computer. It was a 486 playing some of the old SimCity sort of games. So a lot of DOS-based games. And I broke the family computer on a regular basis. So when you've got a very scary mum, you try to fix the computer before she finds out that you've broken it. So that was a very strong motivator to have that hacker sort of mindset to get in and try to break things. And the motivation was to A, not piss mum off, but then also to be able to play the games again. And it kind of grew from there, playing more PlayStation games and things like that. And through high school, I just wanted to get more and more in software and make the games. But at some point that pivoted to, it's not really about I want to make the games, I just want to keep writing cool and interesting things. So kind of went from there, and that's where my university story kind of started, and then my career trajectory from there, if we wanted to get into that. So.
Yeah, man. So you did do the university thing, I know, and you've done a bachelor's degree, or two bachelor's degrees, isn't
two.
It? Two now.
Yeah.
And you're obviously somebody that believes in a degree. Are your thoughts on university degrees for tech professionals?
So I've listened to a few of your podcast episodes, and every time I hear other people answer it, I think to myself, how would I answer this? And I've been very conflicted every time I've thought about it.
I think I change my opinion on a weekly basis.
Yeah. So the thing that, from a student perspective, I look at the fees that I've paid, and I'm like, what did they actually give me? I could have done this myself. Because what it is every semester, they've picked four textbooks. Make sure you know 80% of the content, you'll be assessed on at the end. Whether or not they teach you that, a lot of the time people say, oh, I learned how to learn, because they weren't exactly delivering the content particularly well. So it forces you into a corner. And because you spent thousands of dollars, that's a very big bet on yourself to, I'm going to learn this by a deadline. So really, if we had like a betting agency where I give you $3,000 and I'm going to understand this textbook and you're going to assess me on it in 6 months' time, that's kind of a university education. So from a student perspective, it's like, I could do this myself. But from an employer's perspective, how do I know that you know these things? So if you go to a boot camp or a code school or one of these online things, how much of that is just printing out a qualification, but you don't actually know how to do it? So as an employer on the interviewer side of the table, we've had our teams do those like hacker rank sort of tools, just so we can do a baseline of what does that team actually know? And then if we get candidates to do the same test, we know where they fit on that distribution. So I strongly believe in doing a technical interview just to make sure that someone knows what they know. And there is a huge difference between someone that comes out of with, you've got a Bachelor of Computer Science with a passing grade, Bachelor of Computer Science with a high distinction, very different people. So how does that signal to an employer? What do you actually know? Like, what's the difference between some random on the street and someone who's actually going to be competent at this job? And it's very hard as an employer to figure out in 30 to 60 minutes. It's like the first date. You've got to try and figure out a lot about this person. Do they have poor life choices? And can they communicate with me? How do they handle conflicts? And can they do the job? Like, so from the prospective employee side and the employer side, it seems like a very weird relationship how the industry's evolved. And I don't understand where I sit on what's the value of it. It's useful, but I'm not entirely sure where I sit on its entire value.
Yeah, nice. It's an interesting question, right? I think it's an evolving question as different educational resources evolve as well. What used to be, hey, you need a degree and a degree in its entirety. Mm-hmm. I think it's starting to break down into sort of micro degrees and like parts thereof degrees. Yeah. And then you add a part of degree with a course from another provider, another private institution, things like that. And that could become, you know, the ultimate way to become a gun software developer or something else, right? And
that's where I think the landscape's shifting. Yep. Like, we've had a very traditional institution, but proving you know something, I think that's changing.
Yep.
And I've had interns come along and say, I started doing 2 years of mechatronics, but then I switched to computer science. And they're like, oh, I'm not actually qualified in mechatronics, but I've done a bit of it. I'm like, to me, you've just done a combined degree. It doesn't officially say that, but you can't unlearn the things that you've done in that 2 year span.
Correct.
So I think I encourage them to, in future, put that on their resume every time, even though they haven't got that formal qualification.
I completely agree. I think, an entire degree doesn't suit everyone, and there's parts thereof that are extremely valuable, and there's parts thereof that are there to tick a box because you need to tick that box to get your degree or to get your past course. Whereas not all of them are valued, they're not all weighted equally, or they shouldn't be.
Mm.
I think there's definite value there, but I think it's what are you hoping to achieve out of that? Where is that progressing you? What are you trying to achieve from a particular course, whether that be an entire degree or a part thereof?
Yeah, so recently I've done a graduate diploma of data science.
Yeah.
So the reason I started that is because at interviews, I was blocked. I got rejected because I hadn't done any postgrad qualifications.
Yeah, right.
They said, great, you're awesome, but this PhD candidate, they're the hotness. So I was like, crap, I've got to go back and do something.
Yeah.
I got a lot of credit for things that I've already done in industry. Awesome. And just by starting studying, Komatsu picked me up and said, yep, close enough. All right, awesome. So sometimes you don't need the full degree, just the intention.
Yeah,
got me over the line in that interview. So they've helped me finish the graduate diploma, and I'm not going to continue the master's because that syllabus is exactly what my job is. So I'm going to get them to pay me to learn that now. So.
Yeah, entirely, mate. I'm not a believer in you need to have a piece of paper to get a job. I think there's better ways to assess a candidate in a job rather than have you got a piece of paper or have you completed XYZ.
Yeah.
They can be good indicators, but they shouldn't be a eliminator of people because they don't have a particular course or degree.
I fully agree. Sort of
narrow-minded. That might not be popular, but that's my opinion.
There's possibly people that have that mindset. If you don't get recruited by them, you've probably dodged a bullet as well.
Yeah, potentially. I agree. Okay, so I mentioned a couple of times just there on other parts outside of formal education. Have you undertaken sort of other courses outside of, you know, the university landscape, and what's your experience been from that perspective?
So I've taken on probably half a dozen online courses through Coursera, Code School. So just augmenting what I already know.
Yeah.
Data Camp is a really good one.
Yeah.
So there's doing a certain amount of formal training, but then I try to do continuous learning.
Yeah.
At university, it's, you know, four textbooks a semester. So I try to aim for 8 books a year, audio books or online courses. So I try to keep myself up to speed.
Yeah.
Because it keeps shifting in this landscape.
It does, right? Completely. And I think that's where education is moving, right? It's moving to lifelong learning. It's moving to, I think the best person for the job sometimes is somebody that's got proven ability to learn, right? Yes. If you're a developer and you probably went through uni, if you went to Newcastle, you probably learned Java, right?
Yeah.
And,
amount of people I've interviewed and like, so what programming languages do you know? And every candidate that comes, they look identical. So yeah. I'm like, so what else have you done?
Yeah.
Not much.
Yeah, so that's a differentiator, right? So somebody that's gone outside the degree and done something through, you know, Code Academy or something like that, and said, hey, I've also gone and learned, you know, some form of JavaScript, or I've learned XYZ on top of, and that's the differentiator. There's sort of things that I look for when it's just like, okay, yes, you've done that, but what else have you done to sort of further your education? I think those sort of things, that ability to learn, or as you said before, that intention to even sign up for your master's, right, is... Yeah. It's a good sign to say, hey, you're an intention to continue your learning. It's probably a fair indication that says, hey, if you go into a job, you don't know something, you're a guy that actually invests in learning, you'll pick it up.
Yeah. Flipping that around, there's one company that I was very impressed with that I used to work for called CloudSense. They work out of the Byte2N hub on Elm Street. They just, as a policy, have a paid subscription to Pluralsight. And when they hire people, you might not know Node.js or Java or C#. So they say, you know, your first month in onboarding, go spend a month on Pluralsight, get yourself up to speed. Or if there's some new technology transitioning projects, they say, yep, just go get a key from the admin and go to town. So they integrate continuous learning as part of just being an employee. So I thought that was really innovative on their part.
Yeah, I agree. And it's a good way to continue to upskill your people, right? People invest a lot in getting people on board, whether it be through recruitment, or the bigger cost is, you know, getting people up to speed, getting people to know your technology, getting people to know your company, your ways of doing things. And hey, if you continue to, you know, allow them opportunities to grow, you're a higher chance of keeping them, right?
Yeah.
That's cool. And it's all with, different companies do it to varying degrees on how well they do it. Cool. If you had to then provide advice, to somebody coming out of uni at the moment, and they had to look to an external provider for, say, learning a new programming language or something like that, what would your positive experiences be? Where would you point them?
Very hard to say, because Coursera was the bee's knees when I first went onto it, but it's shifting and it's making it very unaffordable. So I'm not sure what would be a good one, because the price tag, as a student, it's very hard to get over that hurdle. As a professional, it's like, I can afford that, but I know as a student, it's like, it's not quite at that $7 a month price tag. So it's, I can't really point to anything specific, but I can point to, you know, Data Camp is really good. The Code School, or Code Academy, I think it was, but they've probably been bought out by someone else. Pluralsight is really good, but it's, again, price tag.
Yeah.
So other than that, YouTube. YouTube's an amazing resource, and I look at a lot of conference videos as well. There's a lot of university lecturers in US campuses that do, they'll record their lectures for the entire year and just post them up.
Yeah.
So it's like, I've followed quite a few of those actually.
Yeah, content's so readily available these days, right? It's extremely hard to pay or to charge for content unless it's extremely good. There is so much free content out there. As you said, there's a lot of the big name universities from the US providing online, they're actually online, you know, parts of their degrees for free online.
Yeah. It's crazy.
It's a good time. It's a good time. It's a good time to be alive and be, have access to that type of thing, right?
Exactly.
Go sort of deeper into you. You've built your career. You've gone through your education, obviously. In your day-to-day job, what sort of productivity tools do you use on a daily basis to sort of, you know, keep your days ticking along, keep yourself accountable?
So more specifically, as a software engineer, using version control and a tool called Vim. So it's a text editor, but it's very programmable.
Yeah.
So I use that day in, day out, because I'm a technologist, so I'm making technology. So that's a responsibility on me to keep automating my tools as well. So the fact that my tools are programmable, I have no excuses to keep iterating on what I'm doing. It's like the blacksmith back in the day. He was the tool maker in the town. So he had no excuse to not have the best tools, because he's the one that made his own tools.
Yeah.
So it's that sort of mentality. Other than that, we use Azure DevOps, and there's a Kanban board.
Yeah.
So we use that for a lot of day-to-day project management to make sure that we're, our team's aware of what we're doing, and just got old-fashioned calendar to time management.
Yeah.
One trick that I do that I don't think many people do, set up multiple calendars, and just because you've got different colors, I categorize my time on different calendars. So when you have that layered view, I can see, all right, that's how I spent my day, just in a glance.
Yeah.
So I'll just like, I'll add this to, there's meetings, there's development time, there's chores and things like that.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny when you actually retrospectively look at your calendar and look how you spend your days, and you're like, oh, why wasn't I so productive that week? Or why was that a productive week? And you're like, oh, because of X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
Having that time to actually look back, because it's one thing to actually, you know, book time out and to, you know, be, you know, have the best intentions, but it's a secondary thing to actually look back and go, hey, how successful was I in achieving whatever it was you were trying to achieve, right?
It's been good, because there was a project that was slipping, and I was getting project managers getting at me saying, why is this slipping? Why are you behind? I showed them my calendar and all the meetings they had booked. I said, when do you expect me to do work? And they're like, oh, so many meetings got canceled after that, the project speed picked up. So it's good to have that sort of time tracking and sort of have a bit of pushback as well.
Yeah.
It's been a good tool.
I completely agree. And that's where tools actually become, you know, really valuable, right?
Yeah.
Meetings for the sake of meetings.
Death by meetings.
From a, I guess, a further educational perspective, outside of the training we've done, is there any, you've mentioned audiobooks, you try to listen to 80 years, is there any other hardcore books or audiobooks that you've listened to lately that you'd highly recommend?
So there's one book I've been pushing onto my team called The Phoenix Project.
Yeah.
And it's based on another book called The Goal, where they take like lean manufacturing and the lean startup sort of methodology, which is essentially the scientific method. I have a hypothesis, I'm going to test it, and I iterate on that, and you have a feedback loop, and you close it. But the way they've applied it is to an IT environment. And as a knowledge worker, you have a lot of invisible work in progress. And the way they've written the story is first person. So you follow around this guy called Bill in an IT department, and everything's on fire, and he's trying to recover the business. And it's really good in the audiobook form, because the voice acting is superb.
Yeah.
But I've been pushing it onto my team, because I've read it twice now. Other companies I've worked at, multiple colleagues have also read it and loved it. So I've got a bet going with my team. If you read it and you get nothing out of it, I will give you $100 for your time. That's how strongly I recommend it.
So nice. What was that called again?
It's called The Phoenix Project.
Do you know who it was by?
There's three authors.
Okay, we'll link that up in the show notes anyway. I'm sure we'll be able to find it. That'll be an interesting one. That's good. It's good to get a highly recommended book like that, right? That's one that you can go, yep, I'll put my own dollars on that.
Because if they don't get anything out of it, it's like, all right, fair enough, I'll pay for that. But I can guarantee that I'll have better colleagues for them understanding what the idea is of planned and unplanned work and invisible work and being on top of that. Because there's so many like subtle issues when you're just focused on solving your immediate problem and not looking at the whole project.
Yeah. Outside of audiobooks then, Twitter. Anyone, Twitter, do you follow anyone on Twitter, or you follow any blogs or anything that you'd recommend for people to say, hey, you should definitely follow this, or you should definitely be a subscriber to XYZ?
So there's a website called realpython.com. Yep. So I follow that, and the guy that runs that, Dan Bader, he's a bit of a luminary in the Python ecosystem. He does a drip email feed thing where he'll send out once a week a little snippet like, did you know you can do this in Python? But also he links to their blogs. on, it's a decent sized article, so here's a feature of Python. Go deep on it, or as little or shallow as you want on it.
Yeah.
So they're really awesome. It's very high quality. And I was working on a Python project a few years ago, had a few years away from it, and now Komatsu is very Python heavy. So I had to do like a 2-year catch up. So Real Python was awesome for that. And there's a few podcasts, so listen to a 2-year backlog of podcasts, and I get that historical catch up as well. Yeah, like, what's happened in the industry?
Nice. What are the podcasts of choice?
That was Talk Python to Me and Python Bytes.
That is a lot of Python catching up then.
Yes.
Booking a couple of podcasts. I mean, as you said, that's one of those things, investing in self, investing in time, right? It just doesn't come by chance.
Before coming in, I checked how many podcasts I listened to. It's like 15 a week that I listen to.
Yeah, right.
But that's because whenever I'm mowing the lawn, doing the ironing, washing the car, housework, like my wife's happier that I'm doing it, but like that's my go-to time to catch up on podcasts. So I smash your fair bit of content.
Yeah, nice. Any other podcasts you'd recommend outside of that to people?
There's a really good one called No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yeah.
It's not a technical one, it's just a whole bunch of fun facts told by four British comedians. So
yeah, nice.
That's good one to break it up.
It is good to break it up with that. Like, you, from an educational perspective, it's good to throw in something else to just break it up from time to time as well.
Yeah.
Quite a well-known guy within the Newcastle technology scene, probably because of your involvement in the JS meetup for some time now, and more recently the Nui Data meetup. Yep. Like, give us a quick overview of, you can talk about both of them, where the meetups come from and the positioning for each, so who each serves.
So the Newcastle JS is a JavaScript. Well, in the title, it's JavaScript, but we say anything that kind of touches JavaScript. So it's more of a web development meetup.
Yeah.
But JavaScript is now on a lot of embedded devices, like the Raspberry Pis.
Yeah.
So it's very pervasive, and Node.js as well, so server side. So it's getting everywhere. So there's a fair bit of content. So that started 2016 by a couple of other, I can't remember the names off the top of my head, the other founders that worked in Sydney. There's a Sydney JS meetup.
Yep.
And then wanted that to be in Newcastle. So I started that up, and Kathy Lil, she's one of the original founders of the Newcastle JS. And I came on when she actually wanted to go on maternity leave from a volunteer thing, saying, hey, we need more hands, who wants to help? And I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll jump on. So that was start of 2018.
Yep.
I've been involved in that, so all of last year. And since I was involved in that, I heard a lot of people saying that, oh, this data science stuff is kind of interesting. So I've heard a lot of people having that interest. Then when I moved to Komatsu, my boss was like, oh, there's no real data analytics meetups in Newcastle. I'm like, well, I run a meetup. It's not that hard. We should do it. So I gave him the nudge, and this year we kicked it off. So that's been going for 3 months now, and had a head count of about 30 each time. That's been pretty good.
Well done.
So we're hosting that out of the Newcastle Uni campus, so they've been quite helpful to spot a venue for us for that.
Very nice, mate. Two meetups. Let's talk about some challenges. Mate, what's the biggest challenge with running meetups like this?
It's volunteer time. So yep. If I'm doing that, it means I'm not spending time with my wife and I'm not doing other activities. So it's good to have other people involved in running it.
Yeah.
And being very deliberate and efficient with how I do spend my time on it. So being a workaholic, it's very easy to put an infinite amount of my time and energy into it, but keeping a bit of perspective that it's a regional meetup. Like, let's not go overboard, Josh, and sort of keep that in check.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's very important. I think it's very easy to overcommit to these type of things. And as you said, it is a voluntary gig. And you know, the more people that can get involved to pitch in, you know, many hands make light work, right?
Yeah, so I do try to emphasize that every meetup that we are volunteers, so you get what you pay for. But I noticed recently I've been starting to burn out, so I'm trying to meter how much time and energy I do put into any given event.
Yep, on the frequency then, so just for the people once again, let's pretend people don't know of these events, frequency of both the events.
So Newcastle JS is every odd month, and Nui Data is every month.
Yep.
And that's one of the key things, having in the meetup.com, search for tech in Newcastle, there's like a half a dozen of them, or actually there's many, like 20 of them actually.
They're all now on uetechpeople.com.au.
Yes, I see those updates on LinkedIn every week.
Yeah. So we're trying to do our little part to, you know, promote what's going on, right? Yeah. And promote the Newcastle tech scene and what is going on, because there is plenty going on, right?
Yeah.
And I guess one of the challenges in the past, I think, is just the lack of knowledge around how big the Newcastle tech scene is and how deep the Newcastle tech scene is. But definitely not, you know, a major city like a Sydney or Melbourne or Brisbane from, you know, size and scope. But I think I think there's a misconception regarding Newcastle tech scene on how deep and how involved it is. I think there is a really growing vibe in Newcastle from a technology perspective.
And I was a victim of that.
Yeah.
Because I was working in North Sydney, commuting from Newcastle just through personal circumstances.
Yep.
And that soul crushing, catching that train every morning. And yeah, so that was hard. But I felt like I was trapped because I felt like there wasn't many jobs in Newcastle. But I was looking at only the ones that were advertised. And there's almost like this dark matter sort of space of the recruitment scene where you have to network with people. So getting involved in the meetups really slingshotted my career by coming back, getting involved, talking to people and saying, oh yeah, we're recruiting. We haven't put an ad out just yet, but come have a chat to Steve or Joe or whatever. And going to these meetups, it's kind of a monthly careers expo and you get free pizza. So that's awesome. And yeah, there's so many popping up now for the different industry focuses as well.
Yeah.
So it's really awesome space and I'm really glad that I've been involved with that. I had a stand for Komatsu at the University Careers Expo the other day. So half of it was pushing the company, but the other half was like, if you want a job, go to meetups.
Yeah.
Like, they are a monthly careers expo. Talk to people.
Yeah, as you said, like I don't think for anyone that's out there and is hired in their team, I don't think Seek's a really valuable resource. You know, we use it as much for just an advertising perspective. Advertising, you know, the way we're working a number of jobs at the moment rather than actually using it for talent pool. There is not, you know, that doesn't tend to be the way that you find the best candidates. How you can get lucky through there from time to time, but
yeah,
it's the reason, you know, I've got a job. It's because if Seek ticked all the boxes, it'd be a no-brainer, right?
As a student, I didn't know that. I thought Seek was, that's the entirety of the landscape. That's all the opportunities. So when you're looking at those numbers, and it is a numbers game. I only need one job. So that's why people go to Sydney, because there's more numbers down there. So just rolling the dice and better chances. But from an employer side, I didn't realize that how hard it is to find people. So you try to exhaust your personal network first. So that's why it's good to network with people. But then if you haven't exhausted that, then we've gone to recruiters and it's like, who do they already know? Who do they already have on the books?
Yeah.
And then if something's on Seek, that's usually the last resort.
Yeah.
So it's like, if you're only looking at Seek, you're kind of limiting yourself.
Don't disagree at all.
So I have not had a job from a Seek ad my entire career.
Yeah. I do not think that will change.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, the further you go up, you know, you'd be tapped on the shoulder relatively frequently, I imagine. And, That's how it works, right? And it's all about networking. So on that networking side, then for people that aren't involved, you know, in the meetup scene, you've obviously mentioned more so from a grad's perspective, hey, there's an opportunity to come there from a job, you know, learn about other companies and things like that. If you had to say to people for, you know, Newcastle JS and UE Data in particular, what's the selling point for people to come along for both of those?
Well, networking, as I mentioned, that's probably got a bad connotation to some of the listeners, but when I say that, I mean having a genuine conversation with people that are interested in the same field as you.
Yeah.
Build those relationships, nerd out with them, have a good time. That is networking. It's very casual, but most of the time there is a talk on something in your industry, but it might not be something that's within your discipline. So it's good to see a variety of other ways that people have solved problems. So I really love the learning diverse solutions. So that's the education aspect of it. So there's two halves, the networking and education. So
yeah, I think so. I think there's the education part's a big one, right? I think there's two sides and different people go to different meetups for varied reasons. But I think that educational piece is not only sometimes from the speaker that you might hear from, but talking about some of the problems you might have at work, and there's a high likelihood that somebody's going through something similar or has gone through and succeeded with that sort of thing, right? So you, once again, it probably falls under a mix between the networking and the sort of technical, you know, learnings. But there's a massive benefit from that.
Yeah, I love they call that the hallway track at conferences, where you're just talking to random people and say, oh, what do you do? Oh yeah, I do this. Like, oh, we've got this problem. Hey, have you tried this framework? No. Awesome. That one conversation has probably saved us 3 months of work. And it's, I go to a meetup trying to, if I can learn one new thing, it might be the most simplest thing, but if it's a productivity hack and it saves me an hour in my week, it's like, I can sort of look up Reddit for an extra hour.
Yeah, nice, mate. I guess another challenge with meetups is always sponsorship. If people are looking to sponsor either of the meetups, you're the guy to reach out to.
So we have, for each of the meetups, a Twitter channel.
Yeah.
Or the meetup page is probably the best point of contact. So don't hit up me directly, because there are other people behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And spread the load.
Yeah, perfect. All right, and you are looking for sponsors always?
Yes, always good to have a backup list, because we had a sponsor fall through for the JS meetup.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the year, it goes quiet over Christmas.
Yeah.
So we like to thank all our sponsors and say, oh, hey, are you still interested in sponsoring next year? We'll circle back. We'll go to circle back in January. Dead. Possibly because the person that was our contact has left the company and we have no other point of contact. So things like that happen, but Newcastle community is pretty awesome.
Yep.
The Newey Slack channel, there's actually a private channel where we've tried to corral all the meetup admins.
Yep.
So I think it was the IXDA meetup. They were meeting out of the Edwards.
Yep.
Unfortunately, Edwards burnt down. They were looking for a new venue. So they reached out to the rest of the meetup. People saying, hey, where's a good venue? And we all supported each other and helped them. Hey, here's a new venue. So that's also a good community. If you are a meetup organizer, get involved in that. We've been really good at making sure we don't conflict with times as to stealing each other's audience.
Yep.
So if we spread out over the month, it works a lot better for the entire tech community wins.
I could not agree more. I could not agree more. And that was sort of our reasoning behind trying to build that calendar, was just to give some more visibility to, hey, you know, this is what's coming up. Let's not book things on the same day, right?
Yeah.
It's crazy for us to sort of cannibalize our own market, which has definitely happened in the past, right?
Yeah.
Conflicting meetups is crazy in a community as big as ours.
So there's a conflicting data meetup.
Yeah.
But where I was looking, trying to do a bit of background research, does one exist? They weren't on meetup.com yet. So they had no social media visibility in Newcastle. So we started at the time that they flipped over to Meetup. So now there's two of them running.
Yeah.
So,
I'm sure that sort of thing should sort themselves out over time, right?
So we're in chats with them to see how we can collaborate rather than compete.
Yes.
What's the point? Like, we want Newcastle to win.
Yeah, mate, you're not out there doing this for your own financial benefit, right? You're out there for the community's benefit. So, I think there's people with the right intentions, and, you know, things should work the way out over time. On the Newcastle thing there, you mentioned before, so that's sort of our meetup, you know, wrap up, but Newcastle, you just made mention before, you did finish uni, went to North Sydney, did that horrible commute.
Yeah.
And what's your thoughts on, obviously, why you did it to begin with, and your thoughts on the state of the Newcastle tech scene at the moment?
Start with why I went away.
Yeah, let's start there.
I love the metaphor of the transition of going from a boy to a man, where they would go and climb a mountain, and then when they come back down, they would be a man. In my head, I always wanted to literally climb a mountain and do that, but what I found happened was I started at a Central Coast startup called Invoice2Go. It was me and the founder. So I was the first employee. He'd been hard slogged for 7 years on that, but I, over the next 6 years, got to watch that company grow to 100 employees, had offices in Indonesia and San Francisco. So my first real job out of university, I managed to eventually work in Silicon Valley. So that was my dream. I wanted to work in Silicon Valley. Along the way, I lived in Jakarta for 6 months whilst we started that office up, and getting to see how other people in the world lived outside of Newcastle. And then I had the fortune of staying, and the company paid for me to live in San Francisco for 2 week stints at a time whilst I was starting that office up. So I was living the dream. I'm a software engineer, I'm working in Silicon Valley. This is awesome.
Yeah.
I was also running a careers expo stand at Stanford University. So I've got Stanford candidates coming to me, a Newcastle boy with a computer science degree, saying, hey, can I work for your company? Well, this is kind of cool. And then the people that I was working with were from Stanford. This is a university that I've idolized, but I'm keeping pace with them. So my computer science degree is holding its ground. And it's like, to me, that was, I didn't realize it, but that was hitting the summer. I've seen what it's like, and there is no magic. It's people, right? They're then having gone away, I appreciated what I had, what got me to that point from Newcastle, and the lifestyle and what I can achieve here. And it's a commute down to Sydney, and it's very long. So you wind up reading the New South Wales Transport Master Plan, for their 20-year plan for what's coming up. And part of that is all of what's happened with the revitalisation of Newcastle, the tram line.
Yeah.
And I saw then the New South Wales government is investing heavily in Newcastle. It's like awesome. NBN rollout, there's a whole lot of new office space. We have no excuses to be our own Silicon Valley here. So seeing that and the council's investment in smart cities, and I was getting heavily into a data sort of role, I was like, all right, that partly influenced my going back and doing postgrad.
Yeah.
And then the series of jobs that I've managed to land once I've got back here has all wound up leading to a data scientist in Newcastle.
That's cool.
That's pretty cool. But I can take my skill set anywhere in the world. So I'm going over to Milwaukee, where our office in May.
Yeah.
One of the other companies I worked for prior, two of them actually, I went to Cambridge for a couple of weeks and I went to Croatia for a couple of weeks.
That's cool.
And so this is one of the benefits of being in the tech scene. You've got a very transferable skill set you can take anywhere.
Yeah, that whole lifelong learning as well piece, right? Just links in so well. It's just, you know, continual learning, it's continual opportunities, right?
Mm-hmm. And what we can achieve here, like, we're just, there's no excuses to connect with the best minds globally. So that's why I love Newcastle. So that's why I invest so heavily in volunteering my time to really grow the tech scene. So the next generation of students coming out, they've got no excuse to make Newcastle awesome either.
No, completely agree. Completely agree. And the more of them we feed in from the bottom up. So there's two ways to build a community, obviously, bottom up and top down. So from the bottom up, feeding more graduates through to the into the community. And then also bringing some more people, you know, that have done that, go up the mountain and come back as well, which is a lot of people, right? A lot of people, let's say, of the age group, 30 and above, that have done the university degree, probably didn't realise the opportunities that were in Newcastle at the time, moved away, went to Sydney or elsewhere, learned, you know, grew their career, extremely knowledgeable now, could be extremely valuable back into the Newcastle scene. So if we, you know, adding people at the top, bringing new experiences in whilst feeding the bottom, with a strong graduate pool, I think that's the key to continued growth, right?
Yeah.
What's your, so let's say the last 5 years or the last 3 to 5 years, what's your experience with the growth of the Newcastle tech community in general?
Well, you've had the founders of Newcastle Coders Group, so they've been keeping it steady for the last 14, 15 years. So hats off to them for keeping that beacon lit. Right. But the last 3 years, it's just gone nuts.
Yeah.
And I can't attribute it to anything in particular, but there's just been a rapid growth in the companies that are around.
Yep.
There's just more people doing tech-based roles in Newcastle. And yeah, there's just a lot more investment in that scene. So with having more people around, people want to hang out and have coffee, have a beer, and just grow their career trajectory as well. So yeah, it's been really awesome.
On that note, we've talked about the successes and the growth. What's the biggest challenge for being in the Newcastle tech scene?
Parking. Straight up parking.
I still think we have that slightly better than some of the major cities.
We do. We're at a teething stage, I feel, where we had it so good for so long where it's like, oh yeah, I can just rock up and park on King Street and like that's my office right there.
Yeah.
Newcastle's going through a change the notch on the belt sort of a growing stage where we need to get big enough that it's not worth taking a car all the way into town. We're starting to get the infrastructure and we just need all the complainers to sort of, shut up, we'll get there. Whereas like Sydney, it doesn't make sense to drive your car all the way in, but they've got the infrastructure there ready to go. There's gonna be a massive population once all these apartment buildings finish. And I think that's gonna change the vibe of what Newcastle is. So watch this space in the next year or two. We're going to have a completely different scene, especially once the university completes their new campus on Harbourside.
Yeah. I completely agree. And then we'll be, as you mentioned, there will be complainers that, hey, it's not the way it was, and that's why I liked it. But hey, that's growth, right?
But every time Facebook changes a feature, it's like, oh, it's not the same. Yeah. It's like, yeah, everyone's going to complain. Yeah. They'll get over it in a month.
That's exactly right. A month's probably generous.
Yeah.
Give it a day or two, and they're like, oh, I forgot what that feature was. I forgot what it used to look like.
We had an observation tower near the brewery. What?
You've obviously listened to a few of the podcasts, and there's been some questions for us. Other people, is there anything else that that you think that you could share with our audience that you think they would find valuable?
So I wish I did this earlier in my career. There's been some inspirational people and mentors that I wondered, how did they get so good at what they do? And then it just clicked. I asked, what books informed where you got to here? And the book recommendations I've got have been amazing. And it's a very low effort conversation for them, but the volumes of hours of indirect mentoring I've got from them, just because a really quality book recommendation, that's been huge. And I wish I did that earlier in my career.
Very nice. Very nice. It's like, yeah, it's learning from the people that have already, been there, done that, right?
Yeah.
And I think most people, if you ask them nicely and you approach them the right way, we'll provide that value. Like, it's a pretty simple answer for them to provide a book recommendation or some, information. If you're not asking the world of them, people are pretty happy to sort of watch the next generation or grow.
And once you finish that book, go have a chat to them again and say, hey, I really like this and this, and engage with them on a deeper level and build that conversation and build that rapport.
Man, I think it ties into the networking, which obviously is one of your strengths. If people do want to reach out to you, where's the best way to find you?
LinkedIn or Twitter.
Yeah.
So we can link that in the show notes.
Yeah, not a worry. Nice. Mate, anything else you'd like to share?
Oh, that's it. Thanks for having me.
Mate, thank you very much. Very insightful. Thanks, mate. Thanks for listening to the episode today. Once again, if you enjoyed anything on today's show, feel free to go to newitechpeople.com.au/podcast for all the show notes on this episode and all our previous episodes. So thank you for everyone that's left a review. And for anyone else that's enjoying the show, please continue to listen. And if you feel inclined, please leave us a review. Thank you.